Okay, so again, apologies for the delay. Last time we were having a look at sort of a very abstract view of how you could lay out a cellular network, so provide wide-scale access to a network. I say telephone network because cells started out as a telephone access and moved to data access, just as the telephone network has moved to providing data access. Okay, and so the basic idea is that you use the property of fading to allow reuse of channels at a distance, and so you lay out your access points, which you call base stations, at regular intervals to form cells. So, and then if two cells are sufficiently far away from each other, they can reuse the same channels. Okay. We then form the cells into, so we have a certain basic set of channels available to us. So we form the cells into clusters and divide the channels up among the cells in the cluster. Okay. And then you repeat your cluster structure. So you need to have then clusters that will cover the whole area and cover it without overlapping. Okay. And so then we ask the question, well, how do we decide how to form our clusters? And so, well, what we want to do is to get some sort of target signal to interference ratio. So, and that's going to be governed by how far away the cells are that are reusing channels, and in particular, you have to look at the ratio of your cell radius to the distance. Okay, because again, your signal is going to drop at the edges of your cell, and then will be interfered with at a certain distance. Okay. So then we observed that if you picked a ratio of reuse distance to cell radius, then determining the cluster size was a geometric exercise. Okay, you just saw how many cells fit in between, fit into that reuse distance. Okay. So, signal to interference ratio governs your required distance to cell radius ratio, which then governs your cluster size. So, what we're going to look at today is some details about implementations of cellular networks, so the 2G, 3G, 4G, we'll leave it at either 2 or 2.5G, depending on how time is going. But just to wrap up our discussion of the basics, I left you last time with a problem to ponder. Okay, and so here, again, we're fixing our target signal to interference ratio. And we have to say something about how our received power is dropping with distance, so what's the fading? So we just pick it to be as a power of 4. And we have a certain number of channels to share amongst our cells. Okay. And so, given our signal to interference ratio, we'd like to know what the shape of our system looks like, so how many cells are there in a cluster, and of course the number of cells in the cluster is then going to determine how many channels you have. Beyond that, once you have a number of channels, then you can ask for how many users can you support. Okay. So here we're going to require a grade of service of 2%. That means that 98% of your users are going to, at least 98% of your users will actually get access to the channels on average. Or they have a 98% probability of getting access. And so the question is, how many users can we support? Okay.
Or
in this case, I haven't said what any user does, so it's actually how many, how much load can the system take, so.
Okay.
And finally, I asked for three different scenarios. So the first is our basic cellular layout, and in the second two, we use sectorized antennas, so we divide the system into either three or six sectors.
Okay. So we start with the first part of the problem, which is determining what our cluster size is, and you know, from there we'll determine how many channels we have per cell. And so again, through our
D to R, we can relate signal to interference to the number of cells in the cluster, and it's 1 over k, 3n to the gamma over 2. Okay. And now, the number of, so k is the number of interfering cells, and we again take just the ones that are immediately adjacent, just the clusters that are immediately adjacent to what the cluster we're considering. Okay, so for omnidirectional antennas, we saw that there would be six interfering cells or clusters, and then for directional, right?
Maybe that is right. You'll either have two or one. I'll have to look at that. I think that's right. Okay. Now, our signal-to-interference ratio was given in decibels. And so we have to translate it out of decibels. Okay. So, solving for n, just again reverse that. So, KSIR divided to the 2 over gamma divided by 3. And we get, for the omnidirectional case, n equals 7. And then for the sectorized cases, we get n equals 4 and n equals 3. Okay, so again, because we have less interference, we can go with smaller cluster sizes. Okay. So to get the number of channels, you just have to, per cell, you divide the number of channels available by the number of cells in the cluster. And then beyond that, again, for sectors, you aren't sharing your channels, so you have to divide the number of channels in the cell and allocate them sector by sector. Okay. So, we get, for any given area, well, for any given cell, 18 channels, then for any given sector we get 10 or 7 channels, but again, more sectors per cell. Okay. So we want to know what sort of load we can have in the system. And so we would either go back to our Erlang table. We have the grade of service, and then we have the number of channels available. And so if you have the two, you can figure out the three. The third component. Okay. And so for omnidirectional antennas, we see we get 11.49 Erlangs per cell. For the sectors, well, we have less channels per sector. So what was the number 7, I believe?
Okay, 10 channels and then 7 channels. So,
given 10 channels, we have a load of 5.048 Erlangs per sector, but then we note that we have 3 sectors. So, we can get 3 times, for the whole cell, we have 3 times that capacity. Again, assuming that your users are actually spreading themselves evenly. Okay. And then if you have 7 channels, you get 2.935 Erlangs per cell. But you have 6, sorry, per sector, but yes, that should be per sector. But you have 6 sectors, so 6 times that Erlangs per cell. So again, if we make some assumption that the users aren't all bunching up in one sector, then we see we do improve the capacity of the cells by doing this. So, again, the cost of doing this is more equipment. You're adding antennas. And then we mentioned last time this, issue of handover. So you have to hand over from sector to sector. And possibly you do not get even distribution of the traffic. Okay, so that's sort of an example that's, you know, sort of, it covers the sort of calculations you can do based on sort of these basic cellular networks, from deciding what the layout is to then deciding what the capacity of the system is for that layout by making some assumptions about the requirements of users. So how many Erlangs would any user use, then you can translate from a load to a number of users.
Okay, so that's one thing. What we're going to look at today is sort of some of the complexity of
that talks about just access, and what we'll look at today is just some of the complexity of turning raw access into sort of network access Okay. So we'll look at sort of the evolution of cellular networks from 1G to 4G, and then we'll, at a very, very high level, look at some of the basic features of the various generations. Okay. Okay, so just from a historical perspective, we start at 1G, and 1G represented analog voice traffic. Okay. So Bell Labs proposed the AMPS cellular system, and it was demonstrated in 1978 and was standardized in the early 80s. Okay. And so the original application was for emergency use, so firefighters, paramedics, etc. Okay, or obviously were mobile and could benefit from having communications in that access, in that sphere. Okay, so to put that in context, AMPS was not the only cellular system to be developed. So it was prevalent in the U.S. and Canada, and throughout various other parts of the world, other standards and implementations developed. Okay, and so what you see here is that even within Europe, you had a lot of different standards. Okay, and none of which would interact with each other. Okay. So, these first systems, again, they had limited range due to implementation issues. They were not, being analog meant that they had relatively small capacities. And again, and they were expensive, so there was they were not widely used. But again, it did slowly grow, and around in the early 90s, you had about 20 million users worldwide. Okay. Now, second generation cellular networks, which are probably where we start looking with interest, moved from having analog to digital signals. Okay. And so the core goal was still to provide voice communications, so it was a circuit switch paradigm. So its primary goal was to get you a telephone call, a voice connection, where, again, the voice signal was digitized. Okay. But once you have a digitized signal, you can start to send other forms of data along the same lines. Digitization led to improvements in the quality of the signal, in the system capacity, and sort of, again, the ability to then to provide coverage. Okay. So there were still a lot of 2G standards. Okay. A lot of with a lot they tend to be distinguished according to their multiplexing techniques. A lot of them were TDMA based, but code division multiple access, so a spread spectrum type techniques also began to appear. So again, to improve signaling quality. The one that we're going to focus on is GSM. And this started with a European base, but sort of has spread worldwide. And 2G would be the dominant 2G standard. Okay. But again, other 2G standards were also proposed and sort of implemented in different parts of the world. So again, different standards, no interoperability. So you were still limited to whatever the coverage of an area of a certain standard was. Okay. Now, evolving over time, GSM dominated as a standard. Its usage is declining. Obviously, as 3G and 4G arise, but its usage is also evolving. So it's being seen as sort of an alternative networking solution, possibly outside of the cellular world. For instance, PhoneWatch uses GSM to implement its wireless monitoring systems. So it's changed the usage, but it's still there. In developing countries, it's frequently used just because it's relatively inexpensive. Well, again, there is evolution to uptake the 4G standards.
The older the standard like that gets, is the more pressure put on them for your opinion. Resources that they might be using or allocated.
Yes, there is the sort of regulatory issues about what bandwidth they're operating on and licensing. But what's happened in the cellular world is that each generation has gotten new bandwidth. Okay, and there's probably more pressure on, say, radio and television for bandwidth that there is in this space. But yeah, there is pressure to
deal out of it.
But I mean, again, 2G was this digital voice-oriented service, and coming up alongside of that was greater and greater use of networks and network applications. The primary goal of 3G was to allow for IP traffic in a sensible fashion. And in an evolutionary sense, the initial attempts of that were to include this IP traffic within the 2G system, and again, have that and provide reasonable data rates within that. So a move to supporting IP-based traffic, but within sort of the 2G spectrum is usually not referred to as 3G, but is referred to as 2 point something G, so call it 2.5G. Okay. So there are a number of bridging standards that, again, went a long way towards providing the data rates that were envisaged for 3D, but bolting it onto the 2G framework. Okay. So they typically worked by bundling time slots. So, you know, again, you had a certain data rate that was suitable for voice, so you combine enough of those and you might get a decent data rate for, you know, IP traffic. Okay, so there's standards like GPRS, the General Packet Radio Service, again, was built on top of GSM and handled IP traffic as well as voice. Okay. Other options would be Edge for GSM, and in the North American market, CDMA 2000. Okay, so again, we have these different standards, and they all started evolving, trying to evolve towards a 3G service. Okay. So, again, for these historical reasons, there was this sort of lack of standardization, but it's not that people didn't realize that standardization wouldn't be beneficial, so there was work towards standardization, just both in terms of agreeing to what we meant in terms of generation, so what were the goals of each of these generations, and then, you know, there would be later negotiations about exactly how these would be implemented. Okay, so the ITU is responsible for, lots of telecom standards, one of which would be the 3G standardization. Okay, so they would set what the requirements were, and then people could, again, define how they wanted to satisfy those requirements. And so IMT 2000 would be a family of standards then which satisfied the 3G requirements. Okay. The basic goals were to get decent data rates, and again start to get global mobility, and so start to support moving from one standard to the next. Okay, and within data rates, also an acknowledgement of the types of applications that were becoming prominent, so multimedia and real-time applications. Okay. So, within that framework, two predominant standards arose for 3G. Again, from a European perspective, you had UMTS, and that was developed by the Third Generation Partnership Project, 3GPP. And coming from North America,
built again on top of their CDMA systems with CDMA 2000. And so that was developed by 3GPP2. Okay. So, as the name says, most of these standards focused on CDMA modulation techniques, but within UMTS, it was acknowledged that OFDM and MIMO could also be used to support the access.
Okay.
Okay, so 4G is bigger and better 3G, so you want higher data rates. Again, up to gigabits per second if you're not moving or it's moving slowly. Management of heterogeneous networks, so allowing you to hand over from Wi-Fi back to cell to whatever other access you can. Get roaming, so again, the 4G is probably the first standard where it's actually not that complicated to actually move across the globe with a single handset and a single set of protocols operating. And again, things like quality of service support, so we're really, if we have these sort of data rates, we want to be able to use them, stream our videos, etc. Okay, and here again, move to IP services. Okay, so even your voice will be packetized and transmitted as a packet stream. So, IMT 2000, made way for IMT Advanced, which will define these requirements. And 3GPP proposed within that the LTE Advanced standard. And 3GPP2. Started developing a competitor, but actually decided that LTE was the way to go. So, and everything these days is LTE. Within that sphere, everything's LTE. Okay. So, that's nice in the sense that it is now global. There are other standards. Standards and which would satisfy, well, particularly the ideas of the data rates, okay. But they wouldn't be implemented for the purposes necessarily of providing a cellular network. Okay. So the data rate and quality of service improvements are dependent on improvements in radio interface technologies. So in particular, we move from what we said, the CDMA world, into OFDM and MIMO. And we use the sort of tricks we've been using all along. We have error correction codes, and link adaptation. So again, we're going to adapt our modulation and error correction based to our channel conditions. We do things like, again, we aggregate channels to give greater data rates. And again, we now allow for quality of service scheduling as in addition to just sort of FIFO.
So what we're going to do is we're going to start again with GSM, and then we're going to sort of view moving from 2G to 4G as an evolutionary process. By the time the evolution is done, there's not necessarily a whole file left of the original, but it is a rolling process. As was pointed out, each generation, GSM, UMTS, LTE, LTE Advanced, has been allocated its own spectrum or conjugates that coexist with the current standards. Okay. So, what we're going to look at here is how we go about allocating our resources. So, again, what physical infrastructure do we require? How do we negotiate the allocation? And then something about, again, the transmission, the actual transmission of the data. So we'll have a look at the basic architecture for, so we'll start with GSM. Again, you can think of it, a lot of the concepts, again, carried through in terms of architecture and sort of what the basic setup is, and then we can see everything else is evolutionary from there. So we'll spend a little bit of time talking about GSM today, and then probably take up with the rest of the possibilities. Well, in 2 weeks' time, I'll tell you why 2 weeks later. Okay. So, again, what we said before was GSM was our dominant 2G standard. So its goal primarily was to provide digital voice connectivity, but since it was digital, you could also provide the data access as well. But for GSM, that data access is going to be by allocating a connection. Okay, so not the most efficient way of providing data access, but there you go. Okay, it's the dominant 2G standard worldwide. And like anything involving the telecoms companies, it's incredibly complex. Okay, so there's 6,000 pages of standards attached to GSM. Obviously, we're in a little over an hour, going to just hit some real highlights. Okay. So when we started Cellular Basics, we talked about, basically how would you make a voice call? And we saw that, you had to, again, make a connection, just a radio connection to the base station, and that had to be forwarded back through the main network. That which would then try and connect you again outwards to your destination. And we saw issues about finding mobile stations, handing over, etc. So, this is just a bit more detail about that sort of a setup. Okay. So, our system has three main subsystems. We have the base station subsystem, and again, that's what's providing us, our mobile station, with connectivity. And the base station subsystem, again, breaks down to BTSs, so access points, and then controller for those. Then we have the switching system, subsystem. So again, that's concerned with connectivity, you know, end-to-end connectivity. Okay, so this just gets you essentially a channel into the system, but you need to get through the system and again have end-to-end connectivity. So either, again, access to a phone network or a data network, okay? And so all issues to deal with call processing, and we'll go through what those issues are, is handled by the switching subsystem. And then you have operations and maintenance, so monitoring the system, making sure it's working correctly, and of course the most important thing, making sure your users get billed.
So,
that leads to sort of different areas of coverage over which there sort of different units will be responsible. Obviously, our smallest is a cell. So you have, that's one base station, and then gives you your connectivity while you're within the range of that base station. We said a number of cells were connected to one base station controller, and then a number of base station controllers are connected to a single mobile switching center. Okay. The location area usually refers to the number of cells connected to a single base station controller. And that represents, if you recall, the paging range. So if we're looking for a user, we don't keep track of exactly which cell he's in, but we keep track of an area, okay? So a group of cells that they can be in. And so that will be trapped so that if we have to find a user, we can find them. Who does that tracking? The MSC through and connected with a visitor location register tracks the users in a group of location areas, again, where the BSC is connected to the MSC. The MSC, again, only covers a number of BSCs, and therefore there will be lots of MSCs covering the whole range of the network.
And the main reason that this is significant is because of mobility. You're going to move out of cells, you're going to move out of location areas, you're going to move out of the range of an MSC potentially, and then, again, handover will have to occur.
Okay.
So again, what we're doing is we're forming these connections from our user through the base station subsystem to the MSC and out then into the network. And exactly what happens sort of at each stage in that process obviously depends on where you are. And so interfaces define exactly what has to happen at sort of any given part of that path. Okay. And so obviously it's different. You can define an interface that's giving you a connection to your base station than an interface that's communicating between the BSC and the MSC. Okay, so that any two portions of the system that communicate will have these interfaces defined between them, and that tells you what the functionality is and what the communication signaling is. Okay. So if we look at the base station subsystem, again, this is what's going to provide that initial link into the network for the user, and at the back end, move that back to the MSC, so continue the connection back into the actual the system. Okay. So again, we said it had two components, a base station controller and base transceiver stations, where the base transceiver station is your access point, and then the controller is regulating a number of these access points and, again, just then communicating with the MSC. Okay. So what does the BSC do? Again, it's between the BTSs and the MSC, and it makes all of the decisions about cell configuration, so what channels are allocated to which transceivers, then what channels are allocated to the users, and it's the performs handover from cell to cell. Okay. It'll also make decisions about regulating power levels. Okay, so again, it's a centralized decision maker. So that allows you, again, to get balance between the stations, and it also sort of means that you can keep your BTSs relatively simple. Okay. The main concern of the BTS is, again, connecting with the end user. So it does the signaling that's required to do that. We'll go over that in detail later. Some simple control functions, speech coding, etc. Okay, so there's one BTS per cell, and then multiple BTSs per BSC. So the BSC is regulating, again, the access that the user gets by allocating the channels and controlling the handover, etc. Once the user has that access, well, the BSC is also forwarding whatever information the user is sending back through to the MSC. Okay. And the MSC is going to be responsible for creating our
end-to-end connections. Okay. So, there's the switching subsystem and the MSCs look for a core component of that. So the MSCs making all this connectivity. There are additional databases that support this, including the home location register. It's on the next slide, so I'll leave the databases for a sec here. So what does the MSC do? It's going to set up and maintain connections. It's going to make decisions about control of the BSCs. It's going to play a part in handover. Again, what we said was the cell-to-cell handover within the same switching BSC, then you don't need the MSC, but at some point you're going to move farther afield, and again, the MSC will become involved in handover. Yeah, in the same way that the BSC connects backwards to the MSC connects backwards into the telephone network.
So there's a lot of information that has to be stored about the users in order to facilitate this, and in particular make sure that they actually are entitled to access of the network. So that information is stored in a number of databases. The first one is the home location register, and this is going to store all the permanent data about your users. Okay, so what services they're entitled to or have paid for, where they're located currently, and that's going to be indicating the address of another database, the visitor location register. This is often sort of embedded in the MSC. So that's going to be where, if you're trying to make a call to a user, you'll go to the home location register, find out where they are currently, and then go to the visitor location register to find out exactly how to get to them. Okay, and so, we'll have the current status of the user and whatever sort of information is needed. Okay, so that's permanently stored, from a scale perspective, you don't want to have to change that too frequently. So when a user first connects to the network, their information is stored temporarily in what's called a visitor location register. And the only thing that changes them in the home location register is an indication of where they are currently. And the information that's needed
then for them to be making these connections and getting out is stored in our visitor location register. The digital databases, we have an authentication center, and that's used to verify user identity and provide security. And an equipment identification register, which keeps information about the equipment identity. In theory, anyway, it can block calls to, if you report the equipment stolen, it can block calls to that equipment. As far as I know, that doesn't happen a lot.
Okay, so what other little bits and bobs are there? There's a message center, which is used for some basic messaging services. Mobile service node, which handles intelligent network services, so call forwarding and things like that. And then gateways, so either connecting to the telephone network or to a data network. Okay, and our final, just for completeness, we have our operation maintenance center. And again, that's going to monitor the network, so to try and ascertain that it's working properly. If it's not, then it tries to manage the failure and maintains the home location register. So again, just to look at an example of accessing our network, and we'll keep returning to these examples for various purposes. So if we have a phone that's not turned on, it's not making a call, it's still, as long as it's turned on, as long as you've sort of again, verified yourself, it's still connected to the network, okay? So identification of users and authentication of users occurs via the SIM. Okay, and everybody knows what SIM card is. It's kind of what you have in your phone that's tied to a specific network. Okay. So when you power on the phone, you have to look for your nearest access point and make contact, and we'll go into greater detail about how to contact and how that connection is made in a little while. You get an entry, so you'll be connected from your BTS to the MSC. You'll get an entry in the visitor location register, and the home location register will be updated according to what VLR you're attached to. So the VLR gets sort of again information about the user and also stores information about the paging area of the user. Okay, so what if somebody wants to call you? Then, again, that call is routed in through the Gateway Mobile Switching Center, and which will determine the current location of the phone. How? By looking at the home location register, which will point it to the visitor location register. Okay. The home location register will have the status of the phone, so if it's being, again, if it's diverted to another number, it'll say that. If it's not on or it's not currently attached to the network, it can say that as well. Assuming it is attached to the network, again, it knows the VLR, then it will establish a connection to the visiting MSC. So it will establish a connection to the MSC in whose range the mobile is, the user is. Okay. The visiting MSC looks up the user and finds the BSC it's attached to, and requires that BSC to page the BTSs or perform paging via BTSs under its control. So, within that paging, the phone will respond. Phone can respond, okay. And its current location then is returned to the MSC, so we now know which BTS it's attached to. We then can set up the complete connection from BTS back through the network to the GMSC. So again, it's a matter of setting up all these connections at all these different stages throughout the network. Okay. Making a call is relatively simple just because you don't have to actually look for the user. Their location is pinned by, what BTS they communicate with. So the mobile user, again, is going to signal to the BTS, which through the BSC connects to the MSC. The MSC checks the user's credentials, and as long as they're okay, it establishes the connection back through the network. And so, once that connection is made, it's straightforward. Okay. Yeah, let's go for a few more slides, and then we'll take a break. So, two things are going on in telephone networks. We're either sort of sending control messages with the view to setting up channels or managing the network, or we're sending data. In telephony, those two functions are referred to as planes. So you have a control plane and the data plane. It's just terminology, and it refers to
again, what sort of information you're transmitting at any given moment. So is it a control signal or, again,
user data? Okay. And so, again, keep in mind, for telephony, we think of our main goal as setting up an end-to-end connection. So there is a significance to, you know, there's a substantial difference between control data and user data, which user data you can just send along that connection. So there's three basic functions that need to be handled from a control perspective in order to manage these connections. At the highest level, we have just our communications. So setting up and managing our end-to-end connectivity. Underneath that, we have mobility management. So, again, managing users as they move through the system. And so that's things like authentication of users. And then, of course, we have to meet the radio resource management of actually establishing and maintaining radio links. Okay. So the signaling is, again, arranged in a layered structure and, again, has to persist through the various connections, the various interfaces within the system, so from the mobile to the BTS, to the BSC, to the MSC. Depending on where you're moving your signal, obviously different things have to happen. So the protocols will interact with each other in a layered fashion. The interaction is going to be defined by our user interface, and it will therefore be different depending what two elements are communicating. So working our way up, what does radio resource management do? It's going to, again, control the establishment of point-to-point radio links. Okay. So the mobile station, the BSS, and the mobile switching center will be involved in sort of making determinations about link quality and link assignment. Okay. So its goal is to maintain a link between the mobile station and the MSC. And so that includes channel assignment, changes in channel assignment, relinquishing of channels when your connection is torn down, handover, frequency hopping, power level management, again, setting up and tearing down that connection, timing information if as required. Okay. So handover is included in radio resource management, obviously. Again, it's how do you maintain that link as the user moves. And so exactly what happens is going to depend on what area the user is moving out of. So the most basic is just cell to cell, but within the same BSC, so you're changing BPS, but not BSCs. The most basic actually is just changing channel while connected to the same BTS. So again, the channels are being monitored for quality. So if the channel quality degrades, you can be moved to a different channel. So you're handing over within but staying connected to the same BTS. So just changing channels. And secondly, you might hand over from one BTS to a second BTS, but maintain the same BSC. So the BSC is going to decide what your channel allocation is. You might then move from one BSC to another, again, from control change of one BSC from one BTS controlled by one BSC to another BTS controlled by another BSC. And in this case, the MSC will also be involved in the handover decision. Okay. And in particular, again, you're going to need to, your paging area has changed. The BSC changes, your paging area changes. The MSC has to update that. Or you might hand over from one MSC entirely to another MSC, okay. In which case, again, you might have to manage through.
You're going to have to interact with the two MSCs will have to interact.
I mean, is it typically like just one MSC to one cluster, or how does that...
No, there can be an MSC for multiple clusters. To be honest, I'm not sure what a typical number is, but no.
It's more than one per
BSC
anyway.
But you need to have multiple BSCs for an MSC. Okay, so this slide's just essentially a summary of what I just said, so I won't I'm not going to repeat it, but that hopefully summarizes what I just said. Okay. So mobility management allows the user, again, to connect to the network and then move within the network. Okay. And so it manages location. So when you first connect to the network, you have to, again, through the HLR and VLR, it tracks where you are within the network. Okay. And so the location, the mobility management layer handles all the updates that are required and the authentication. Okay. So when you connect, ask for some some user identification. It also provides other authentication and other security measures, so it encrypts your data. Okay. And finally, at the top layer, your communication management establishes the end-to-end connections. Okay. So it establishes and maintains those connections. It checks what services you're entitled to. It's local support, messaging, et cetera. So anything sort of end-to-end is handled by this layer. Okay, so I'm not going to, just the way time's going. If you want to see exactly the signaling and the layers that you go through, you can follow these links. Let's see. But probably not now. Okay, so if you follow those links, which were working earlier but aren't now, my access to them isn't working, you'll see, again, the signaling that's going on at the various different levels. Okay, and in order to start calls, do handover, etc. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. The next topic, which is really fiddly, is talking about how we sort of send both our data and our messaging over the channels, and how channels are arranged to allow us to transmit both our data and our control signals. So we'll take our usual break, and then when we return, we can look at channels for GSM. And so.